Okay, my name is Daniel Schur. I'm the Associate Director of the Institutions for Fragile States Project, and I'm here in New York with Professor Jennifer Widener, the Director of the project, and Police Advisor Andrew Hughes. Advisor Hughes, before we begin, I'd just like to make sure that we've spoken through the informed consent and the legal release, and you have an understanding of those documents.
Absolutely, sir. Yeah.
Okay. With your permission, then, I'd like to begin the interview.
Thank you.
Before we start really talking about policing, we'd like to know a little bit more about you. I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about your background, your position now, and your career trajectory that's brought you to this point.
Okay. Well, I've been a police officer for 31 years. I joined in 1977 a territorial police force in Australia called the Australian Capital Territory Police, which was a small force of around 550. In 1979, the ACT police amalgamated with the then Commonwealth Police and the Narcotics Bureau from the Australian Customs Service to form the Australian Federal Police. That opened up. I was a young detective at the time in Canberra, which was it's the national capital, as the name suggests, and we policed it in a traditional policing sense. When the AFP, the Federal Police, was formed, there was a huge demand for investigators. A lot of senior investigators were taken, and detectives were taken from ACT and moved to national task forces on fraud and drugs and other things. Now, that meant that those who were relatively young had to leap into the front and manage investigations on things that would have historically not come my way for a number of years. So we were doing quite major investigations, and so it was sink or swim, and we learned quickly. And I went into the national side of the organisation in 1983 to Cairns in North Queensland, which is a small station. There was only two detectives there and a number of uniformed police, and worked on federal crimes. And then I went to the detective training school. I was promoted there, promoted out again to the National Criminal Investigation Branch, which, as the name suggests, is a national part of the AFP in those days. Promoted back to the Detective Training School as a faculty head for ACT law and police practices, police powers. Then transferred back to Cairns, in charge of Cairns Station. After a few years there, I was transferred to London as a liaison officer at the Australian High Commission in London, working with UK and European counterparts, primarily on organised crime. I was there for 2 years, and then promoted to superintendent in charge of all of North Queensland, which is a large region in Australia, and then promoted as director of, or commander of, international operations and federal operations, which was an investigative area. So I ran a network of liaison officers around the world, as well as peacekeeping. This is where my first introduction to peacekeeping arose, because the AFP were then in Cyprus, and also this was the start of Timor in 1999, with the first iteration of a series of UN interventions, and this was the referendum to vote on independence. So it was quite a testing time for all, given the events that followed that process. I was then promoted to Assistant Commissioner in charge of all of the operations for the national operations for the Australian Federal Police. Then I moved to Deputy Chief Police Officer back in the ACT, which was where I started it all, as a Deputy Chief there, running all of the operational side of the organisation. And the AFP continues to police the ACT, but in a contractual arrangement with the ACT government. From there, I took up the Commissioner of Police in Fiji for 3.5 years until the coup of December 2006, which saw my removal by the military government. And my name came forward for the UN Police Advisor's position. And while we're waiting for the outcome of that, I took over as Chief Police Officer for the Australian Capital Territory for a few months on an interim basis. And then I was successful in this position, and I arrived here in September 2007 on a 2-year contract. So that's my history.
Excellent, excellent.
As well as that, I had Interpol. I was on the executive committee of Interpol for 2 years, which is an elected position as a 13-member executive committee. That was part-time. You attended 3 executive committee meetings every year, and there was some other work that went with that. But that was an interesting part of my time when I was in the international side of the AFP.
Hmm. Certainly a very wide and varied array of experience within international policing.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things I'd be quite interested to know is the types of briefings and information that you received to prepare you for this current position. What was the type of process that you went through to learn what the issues were and what your responsibilities would be?
Well, as I said, my exposure to UN goes back to 1999, for 3 years I managed AFP deployments to the missions. I visited Cyprus. Then as Commissioner of Police of Fiji Police were then in Kosovo, in Liberia, and in Ramsey Regional Mission, but Security Council endorsed, not a UN mission, but Security Council endorsed. I visited Kosovo, I visited Liberia, I visited UN headquarters in New York in a national capacity as the head of a national police agency. So I experienced a mission activities in those visits and headquarters here. So that was all very helpful. It sort of able to conceptualise, what all this peacekeeping thing was about. But in terms of briefings and preparations, I spoke with the Department of Foreign Affairs, the International Organisations Division of the Australian Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. Obviously spoke a lot with colleagues who'd worked in missions. But as well as that, I'd often spoken to them as friends and colleagues, and so I'd sort of gleaned a lot of their challenge, the challenges they faced and some of the things that they'd done. So I had a sort of an evolving knowledge of peacekeeping operations, and I think because UN policing has moved now considerably into reform, restructure, rebuilding, that was what I did in Fiji. I also, when I was managing AFP's international component, we also had a law enforcement cooperation program, which was several million dollars of funding from government, which enabled us to do sort of modest bilateral development with countries in the globally, but primarily in the Asia Pacific region. So I'd had a lot of reform, restructure, rebuilding work, including firsthand with Fiji, and also in other countries like PNG and Vanuatu, Solomon Islands. So that side of it I was comfortable with. The actual security aspects of police peacekeeping were things that I'd picked up by visiting and by talking and by reading and generally getting a sense of it.
I see. I'm sure, though, that there were many things that would have been difficult to prepare for in this job in terms of the crises and that you've had to face around the world. What are the types of things that you would have liked to have known before assuming this position?
I think, on balance, I think it would have been useful had I had worked in a senior police position in a UN peacekeeping mission. I say on balance because there is part of me which thinks that coming in with fresh eyes was valuable, and this is what the USG, Mr. Gaino, told me when I won the job, that the fact that I was coming in with fresh eyes, the fact that I was coming in with an extensive experience in police reform were all factors that influenced the selection committee to choose me. But having been in the role, I do recognise that, again, on balance, that having that experience would have been pretty helpful.
One of the things you mentioned before we started recording was you thought it would be quite helpful to be able to go back and see what the police advisors' issues of the days were 5 years ago, 10 years ago. In 5 years' time, if somebody was to be in this position, what are the types of things you would like them to know about the issues that you're facing now?
Well, we're actually, a lot of what we're doing at a strategic level here in the police division is focused very much on who my successors will be and what organisation I will leave them to inherit. Part of that is actually making the police identity within the UN system much more clear, much more well known, and much more understood, much better understood by the stakeholders. I also would like to see a concept of UN policing as an organisation. that we have, rather than just a majority of seconded officers, that we have far more professional posts, and that there is a career structure. Someone who wants to become a UN police officer can step out of their national organisation, can join this UN police, and then has a career path up to very senior levels, but that within each mission there is a critical core of professional, well-experienced UN police officers. How we get there, this is all work we're doing now. We're working on expanding our operational support role here at the police division. We hope to get support, continuing support for that growth over the next 12 months. And that'll then place us in a position where we can then start arguing for more professional posts rather than just seconded positions, and this notion of a professional UN police, an international police, with a defined role. So, in 5 years' time, whether we'll get there remains to be seen, but I hope that whoever is there in 5 years will at least appreciate that we've made very solid effort to get to that point.
What are the challenges posed by not having enough professional posts at the moment and having, a lot of seconded officers?
They come, we've got good people, they get more experience by working here, they get really proficient, understand the business, have great relationships with member countries, police contributing countries, with the missions, and then after 2 or 3 years they walk out the door. So I'm continually getting new people, we're training, and that's good in a way. You refresh, and I think we need that. We need an element of that through here. I wouldn't say we just limit to professional posts and not have any seconded officers. I think it needs to be a balance. At the moment we've got precious few. I've got a core of about 3 or 4 who hold down P posts. The rest are seconded officers. So there's not enough. We've got to get that balance right. But member countries are reluctant to fund professional posts. They're more expensive. So I'm led to believe. I don't know how that works, but that's what I'm told. So,
just out of interest, do you have any setups to try and capture the sort of knowledge that people build up in the 2 or 3 years that they're here, so that it's not completely lost?
Yeah, no, we do. We have, the policies are set. Developed by the staff as they've come through, and we have a suite of military term of doctrine, but I prefer policies and guidelines for UN policing activities and a wide range of things. So that continually evolves, and there are gaps, and we're working to fill those gaps, as well as that. You don't have a situation where everyone walks out the door on Friday afternoon and then a whole fresh batch come in on Monday morning. There is always it's always staggered and staged, and we have a core of people who've been here for several years, so the knowledge is there. We need to do more to protect that knowledge though, and I think we need to think more robust database. We discussed this today, and where we our knowledge management needs to be improved. But this project that we're discussing today is a very solid step in that regard, where we capture snapshots in time of critical things, and it's there then for perpetuity. So
yeah, we certainly hope we can contribute.
I'm sure you are.
I'd like to, if we may, talk a bit about the expansion of the policing division. Because I'm sure that poses a number of challenges in terms of recruitment and all these things that we were talking about a bit prior to this conversation. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, we face the same problems as we do in recruiting for the field. There's a number of distinctions that can be made between military and police in peacekeeping. One of them is peacekeeping is core business for most militaries in the world now. They train for it when they're not fighting wars. They deploy people, and to progress in your career, it seems to me, as a military officer, some experience in peacekeeping is not only desirable, it almost seems to be essential. And you see the officers with the chests of ribbons, and you'll note that a number of them are peacekeeping missions. And so it's core business for them. Not the case for police. Core business for police is our domestic responsibilities, our national responsibilities or jurisdictional responsibilities back home. So to draw police from a jurisdiction and to get the best and the brightest, which is what we need to do this complex sort of work, is difficult. Why would a commissioner want to send his best and brightest when he has demands at home? We understand that. So the challenge for recruitment in the field applies equally to recruiting good quality professionals here at headquarters. We do well. I mean, we do get quite a number of good applicants for the positions here, but you can always improve. You know, from time to time we haven't made the right choices, but then the field has been a little bit weak in those occasions. So that's the first challenge, is tapping into the gene pool to get the right people here. The second thing is, of course, the funding, getting member states, the finance committees and so on, the Fifth Committee, ACABQ, the C34, Special Committee on Peacekeeping Operations, on board with it, member countries, on board with the need for the growth. And within the DPKO, to get them to understand the needs. Now, we've achieved all of that this year, so the ground is now well prepared for us next year to actually put flesh on that, or to build the new police division on top of it. And we started again that process today, resumed that process today. We've got to keep the momentum up. We have to market ourselves better. There's still a lack of understanding about what the police do. They still think we are somehow joined at the hip with the military, sort of a boutique outfit that's there and it's nice to have around, but they don't really understand that now we're not just observe, monitoring and reporting, we are into very complex areas of police reform, we're into very complex mandates of executive policing in like Kosovo and Timor, we're doing very close operational support roles in Liberia, Haiti, where our police are quite front line, although they don't have an executive mandate. They're there standing alongside the national police and in other areas as well. So these are complex tasks. So marketing and making everyone aware of this is an issue for us as well.
There's a couple of things I'd like to pick up on there. When you say you're marketing yourselves, trying to do that, who are you speaking to? How are you going about this process?
Yeah, we had my predecessor introduced the initiative of a UN policing magazine. It's a simple process, it's not, but very important one. We had a fellow we engaged, Brian Hansford, a very well qualified and experienced journalist from Wales. He unfortunately, we weren't able to regularise his post, and he left for another UN organisation. But we've just had approval for a 9 months attachment, and we're in the process of recruiting, coincidentally, an Australian media expert who's lived and worked in Europe most of her professional career, including Russia. She's coming on board, and she will be picking that up. But other things we're doing are speaking to meetings of international police leaders like Interpol General Assembly. I addressed them last November in Marrakesh, explaining the role of UN police, the need for quality officers, the fact that it is a win-win situation, because I'll send them back much more experienced, much more exposed officers than when they arrive in the mission. I'm going to be talking to the International Association of Chiefs of Police in San Diego, particularly the International Division, later this year. I think it's in November again. All those opportunities we look for to be able to promote what we're doing internally. There's obviously a lot of meetings we attend where we showcase what we're about.
I'd be interested also to know more about, does the actual recruitment procedure, because this sounds like a massively complex thing when you're trying to identify key people in national police forces literally around the world who would perform well in a UN policing mission. Could you maybe talk me through the process, how you go about identifying and
you mean field recruitment?
Field recruitment, yeah.
Yeah, when the Security Council mandates a mission, there's a resolution and the mandate is there, it normally articulates the number of police individual officers and where appropriate FBUs, foreign police units. Notes for Baal are circulated to the permanent missions here in New York, inviting contributions of police. Then we receive correspondence back diplomatically saying, yes, country X, we're prepared to provide X number of police. We then seek their the P11, the application form. That's a generic UN job profile. There are certain criteria. They have to have had minimum five years policing experience. They must speak the mission language. If invited, we send a team in to do the standard assessment test, the SAT test, which simply checks driving ability, language ability, you know, written and oral, and if it's an armed mission, shooting proficiency. That's not enough. I mean, that's too basic, but we can talk about that in a minute. If all of those things come out okay and that they are, there's no integrity issues, we have to have an undertaking that they're not subject to any internal investigations or criminal matters or corruption or anything of that like nature, they are accepted as part of the contingent. So they're deployed as individual officers. Foreign police units is different. Foreign police units deploy as a contingent, and we send officers to check the equipment. They do a check of the equipment, and then the foreign police unit deploys.
And you said that that's not enough?
No, look, I mean, the shooting, driving, writing, talking is just, when you look at the mandates we're given, as I said, about capacity building, right, executive policing, there's far more to it than that. So we need to, and in Darfur, we went down the path of interviewing individual officers, but we're looking at recruiting 3,500 individual officers. The task was too big, and it was artificially slowing things down. But through coordinating bilateral arrangements, most of the police deploying to Darfur will have undergone pre-deployment training, either within their home country, or where countries aren't in a position to be able to offer that training, through arrangements that we're coordinating between donors and recipients in places like the Kofi Annan Peacekeeping Centre in Ghana and so on. I know some Fijian police officers were trained there recently before they deployed to Darfur because Fiji doesn't have that capacity. So, you know, increasingly we're looking at pre-deployment training. Yeah. We're not there yet, but we're on the path.
And what are the types of things that are involved in pre-deployment training?
Some of it is specific to the mission, as in the case with the Darfur training. So they learn a little bit of culture, a little bit about the history of the conflict and the nature of the work they're doing and so on, and some of the local laws and customs, etc. But there are generic components about being a peacekeeper. Now, this links back to some other important work we're about to start, which is, what does it mean to be a UN police officer? Now, we have 97 police contributing countries. There are more than 97 policing models, because some of those are federal systems, so we draw state, federal or provincial and national police from within a country's contingent, so there's over 100, probably 150 different policing methodologies and styles out there. Some of them are similar, some of them you can block, saying, well, this is the British model, these are more like the American model, these are the French model, but they're all different. So what does it mean when you put the blue beret on, essentially? What do we expect? Now, the guidance material for that is thin, but it's there. And we're looking at things like General Assembly resolutions, human rights, gender mainstreaming, okay? We look at reports of committees, special committees. We look, you know, like the C-34. We look at Secretary General's policy statements, guidance notes. What emerges when you look at all of that material is a democratic policing model. Now, you know, democratic policing model, there's a lot of authoritative work on that, but to me as a practitioner, that means an open, transparent, accountable, fair, responsive, representative organisation, which sees itself as being part of the community and the community is part of the police. That's sort of a concept, you know, very open and accountable, highly accountable, high integrity, professional, that sort of a model. Now, we're going to start work on actually formalising that. So it'll be the International Handbook on Policing. That will be in consultation with other major providers of international police, primarily the EU, the AU, but also some other regional bodies will be consulted on this. We'll have this thing. So before anyone, you know, contemplates throwing the hand up, they must meet certain criteria. They must understand. Most of our countries do not have democratic policing models in their own environment. A lot of them are authoritarian, some of them extremely authoritarian, and they're contributing policekeepers. Now, if we don't do this, the danger is, as you know, if you if you don't train people and make them give them an understanding of what it is to be a UN police officer, in the absence of nothing, they will default to their national policing style. And in many cases, that is not appropriate for UN. So without naming names and name and shame, you know, I think we all know some examples of who we're talking about. You know, that's not acceptable. So individual officers must have a common understanding of what it means to put the blue beret on, what we expect. Now, the EU are looking at us for some leadership in this regard, and we want some input from them. So it becomes, you know, if you go on an EU policing mission for a couple of years, and then a few years later you go on a UN mission, it'll all be very similar, or in fact the same.
Professor, would you like to weigh in on
this?
Yeah.
I'd be very interested in exploring a bit more your past work in Fiji and Timor, and then perhaps bringing that forward to how it's shaped your views and your role today. Perhaps you could explain a bit more to the people listening what the mandate or mission was in Fiji.
Yeah, well, okay. The what happened there is there was a coup in Fiji in May of 2000, a civilian coup, but with military assistance from a rogue outfit called the Counter-Revolutionary Warfare Group (CRW) to overthrow the Chaudhry Labour government by force. They stormed Parliament. The military, the body of the Republic of Fiji military forces, led by Commander Frank Bainimarama, were able, after I think it was over 2 months of this kidnap hostage situation, they were able to eventually resolve it. And they installed an interim government, and that interim government was eventually elected. The decision was made that because they'd just come out of a coup, there was some aspersions that the commissioner at the time, the police commissioner, was in some way complicit with the coup. There was an independent inquiry, but it didn't find enough evidence to proceed, but the shadow of these allegations lingered. It was felt that in this particular time in Fiji's development of evolution, that an expatriate commissioner would be the way to go. Being a Commonwealth country, they approached the Commonwealth representatives who were in Fiji, in Suva, the Brits, the New Zealanders and the Australians. After a process in Australia, my name went forward. I was flown to Fiji, interviewed by the Constitutional Officers Commission, which is the appointing authority for certain statutory office holders, including the police commissioner, and I got the job. Now, I was a member of the AFP. I was seconded to the government of Fiji. AusAid, the Australian Aid Agency, contributed, topped up the local salary to the equivalent of Australian sort of commissioner, and weighed in with other assistance like housing and so on. So I went there, but I put on the Fiji police uniform, I took the oath of office from the Chief Justice, and was a member of the National Security Council for a short time when I arrived, which is rather unusual because I was top secret cleared in Australia. So there's all these sort of anomalies, but, you know, common sense, we worked through that. And I was the, you know, the commissioner of the Fiji Police for 3.5 years. And part of my responsibilities there, aside from managing the force of nearly 4,200, was to reform and rebuild and modernise the Fiji Police. They had suffered, they were under-resourced for forever, basically. And they needed to quickly improve. So with donor assistance, bilateral donor assistance, and, you know, going to government with solid cases, we were able to increase the budget. We increased the size by 800. We were able to get, you know, better vehicles and better systems in place, more IT, tape recording of interviews. There were 42 major projects that we counted that we were running of reform. And quite wide-ranging, but, you know, the things were really happening. It was an exciting time to be there, and I was working my senior executive very hard, but they were relishing it because they'd been neglected for so long. They really rose to the occasion, and we were starting to make differences. Public opinion soared. We had 84% of people in one, 84% of respondents in one poll replied that responded that they felt the police was doing a better job than 12 months ago. This is earlier when we started our reforms. At one point, I had a 94% popularity rating, which I think is too high. I started to question whether I was doing my job properly. That's a bit too high, but you know, all that was very encouraging, I suppose. And we won the Fiji Business Encouragement Award. The next year, which was my last year there, we actually won the Excellence Award for the public sector in Fiji in terms of reform and so on. There was only three of us out of 38 departments, I think there were, that won that. So that was a great achievement for the Fiji police. So, you know, everything was tracking the right direction. Public confidence was growing and crime rate was dropping and everything was going well. While all that was happening, we were managing the next coup, which was the military coup, which happened in December 06. So it became rule of law versus rule of the gun. That was a very testing time. The last 12 months were very, very testing. But, you know, we held our line and we nearly prevented it. We very nearly stopped that coup from happening. We had charges against the commander and most of his senior officers for sedition, for a range of offences around the unlawful removal of 7.5 tonnes of ammunition from the wharf of Suva. But I couldn't lay a finger on him because he always had 100, you know, around 100 at times, bodyguards, military, so we couldn't actually arrest him. And there was an opportunity when he was overseas, I won't name the country, but even though there were offences in that country, they wouldn't arrest. So he came back to Fiji, and there was only one of us going home. He went home and committed the coup. We all knew he was going to do it, and he did it. It was untenable for me to go back. I was going to be arrested upon arrival. So, and I know my people would have put themselves at risk to protect me, even though I was telling them not to. I know they would have. They would have got hurt. And as an expat, you've got to know when to bow out. You know, become part of the problem, not part of the solution. In fact, three of the nine demands he was making to government were about me. So I was becoming part of the problem, not part of the solution. And I felt as well that any solution to this was going to be an Indigenous one, not something that an outsider, an Australian, could fix. It was very much an Indigenous problem. And I had advice from Canberra that it wouldn't be a good idea to go back. So I didn't, and that was the end of that.
Police chiefs running forces in many other parts of the world would love to know the secrets of success in the early part of your period.
Yeah.
In Fiji. One of the things you focused on was development of a training institute and
yeah, that was part of it. That was part of it. A new batch of fresh-faced, young, bright, you know, well-educated, often new breed of police. But there's some very quick things you can do. The optics is very important. Using the media is very important. And I was able to project a very positive, very, you know, fresh style and confident style. We had a uniform committee. They got rid of this sort of... The Fiji police has an iconic uniform, but it's a dress uniform. It's a jagged-edged sulu, which is like a dress and a dark top, and they look very smart in it. But it's not a very efficient operational uniform, but looks great on parades and ceremonial occasions. Looks fantastic. So I put to the committee, design a uniform. They did. They came up with one which looked like an Australian uniform, but nevertheless it also looks like a lot of other police uniforms. Blue shoulder flashes, you know, light blue shirt, dark blue pants, dark blue skirt for the ladies, beret, and, you know, they kept parts of their traditional thing as well. And that had a huge impact. People, when they see police in different uniforms looking smart, the police feel good about themselves. They're in this smart uniform. The public see a change. They see a commissioner on the TV who's confident. They're talking about, you know, the things that were annoying the public about lack of discipline. We doubled the size of the professional standards unit, and I held people to account. If someone did the wrong thing, they were charged, and even senior officers, and all this had a huge impact. The media became very positive, you know, so it starts to fuel itself. They report on the popularity surveys that are done and all that, and that generates its own momentum. So my advice would be, don't overlook the small things. And you may think, oh, what's a uniform? You know, what's a, you know, the commissioner can talk well on TV. These are very important to project that positive image.
It appears from the outside, at least, as though you made a big investment in developing the information resources within the police service, both increasing the ability of people to bring complaints, but also increasing your ability to monitor what was taking place within the services. Could
yeah,
you describe
I had, well, yeah, certainly there was, every complaint was logged and dealt with. You know, there was nothing was swept under the carpet. We had, I had a commissioner's, I forget the term, it wasn't task force because that was looking at investigating the coup of 2000, but there was a commissioner's team led by hand-picked, competent investigators who proactively I would send out. There's a drink in Fiji called kava, which is a made from a root of a ginger-type plant, which is a mild narcotic. And when you drink it, it's a traditional drink, the drinks of the chiefs, but it's become widely available and quite abused. It has a numbing effect. And they were drinking it in police stations and police posts as part of an argument that, well, this is traditional, this is custom. It's not traditional, not custom, because I've looked into it, and the history is it's a drink for the chiefs, not for the common people, but it's become common. But it does dull the mind. Now, it's like having a bar in a Western sort of police station. You just don't do that. You don't go and, you know, sidle up to the bar and have a couple of whiskies and go out on patrol. You just don't do that. And it was making them lack, they weren't responsive, they were lazy, lethargic in many places. So we cut it out up to zero, no kava in police stations. If you want to go home and drink kava, that's up to you, but not in the police station, not on duty, unless it's for traditional reasons. So if they're going to a village and the chief wants to do a traditional welcome, yes, of course, we'll have a couple of bowls of kava. That's understood, and that was accepted, but not just routinely sit around the slush bowl and drink all night. So we cut that out, and I had my team going around to enforce it, and there was a lot of positive hype about that, you know, cleaning it up. People saying, thank goodness, because we'd ring the police station and no one would show because they're all drinking kava around the back. So we cut all that out. I drove home the notion to my leadership about setting the example, and you know, cause continually reinforced it, and they rose to the challenge.
The audit or spot check system is something that I know a number of police services and others have entertained as a possibility. The public often likes them. The police themselves may not, but you won acceptance of this. What would you say was the...
What I said is, look, if we're going to become a professional... Well, if you want a pay rise, you're going to have to professionalise. You can't expect me to go and state the case to government for pay rise, for more equipment, newer cars, if you're not fulfilling your end of the deal. And that's the deal we have to strike here. And when I moved around the police stations and the districts and so on, that was a constant message. Majority of them got it, and they wanted to become professional. They wanted to feel proud of themselves. They wanted to be part of this new reinvigorated organisation. It wasn't a hard message to sell. They also realised they were underpaid. They needed the money. So it was either, you know, lift your game or get out. And I explained to them what I was going to do. I was going to check, and we're going to continually monitor this. And so there was an acceptance that, okay, we understand where it's coming from. And they did get a pay rise. They got a significant pay rise.
And when you put that system in place, did you speak mainly with the police service leaders, the managers around you, or did you address the whole force?
Both. I'd have management meetings, and I would also have as many officers as I could turn up, and it's usually, they have what they call a bure, which is a meeting place, which again is a traditional way of doing it, but that's how they operate. So you bring them into the police station bure, and then address them and take questions and hear their grievances, hear their concerns, and action them. If I say I'm going to do it, I have my staff officer there. I said, make a note of that. And when we get back to headquarters two days later, whatever it may happen to be, we'd go through the list and we'd make sure that they were done. So when I went back there, you know, they would know that I'd ask them, have they fixed that problem you had with whatever it was. And if it wasn't fixed, I'd start to kick someone until it was fixed.
Now, you also developed a newsletter or a magazine within the
had a website, and we had the magazine went out. It was, you know, sort of breezy sort of magazine, and it was devoured by them. You know, they loved it to hear about sporting successes and individual achievements. But we all had contributions from peacekeeping as well. From the peacekeepers in the field, there'd be articles. We had the police, one of the peacekeepers from Liberia, writing for one of the major daily newspapers. Every Saturday morning there was a feature article on what happened that week. So the police peacekeeping was promoted within Fiji.
And how did you deal with the press, the regular newspapers? Did you hold press conferences?
Yeah.
And that was how they began to know about the
press. I made myself available. I probably count on one hand over 3.5 years when I was unable to talk to the media. And it was either unable because it was sensitive and I didn't want to try and, you know, come across as, you know, as trying to make some sort of lineup. If I couldn't speak on an issue, then I'd say, well, I'm sorry, I can't talk to you. It was very rare. But yep, if there was a issues-driven media conference, I'd call it, explain what it was about, and they would turn up in numbers. Then there'd be break. After those, I'd usually say, can I see you afterwards? And they'd come and see me one-on-one and talk about it, and, you know, whatever it is they wanted. But I hope, and I'm confident I did, have the reputation for being open and available and approachable. And if I said something, you know, they could reliably say, well, you know, well, the commissioner said it, so it's got to be right. And I'd never, never intentionally deceive them, and I wouldn't, because trust is a very, very fragile thing with the media. They're always thinking, you know, you're trying to push an agenda or hide something. If I was trying to conceal something, I wouldn't talk to them, and they'd have to understand that there are certain operational things which are sensitive. Can't divulge it yet. So.
Were there any other efforts to reform what people were, or what police were doing on the street with the citizenry at any time? One of the examples we've had in another conversation is new categories of police activity were opened up to bring the public on board, to make them feel as though the police were actually doing something on their behalf.
Yeah, one of the major projects was community policing, and getting engaged with the community much more than we were in the past. Other things like the more representative nature of the force. When I arrived, there were 10% of the force were female. We were able to get that up to 18.6%, and our goal was 25%. I had women in senior frontline operational roles for the first time in the history of the force. So the image of the force became, you know, I'd say softer, but, you know, it's not the right term, but you know what I mean. It wasn't such a macho, male-dominated rugby, you know, thing that it was when I arrived, and it became much more representative of the community. Yeah, rugby, we were good at rugby. We beat the military, and for this annual trophy, for the, you know, it was great. We did that 2 years in a row. So, you know, so the sporting, I encouraged the sporting thing, but the sporting thing was not only that their health wasn't good, their well-being was bad because they drank too much carver and they ate too much and bad food, but to reintroduce the sporting culture where they were encouraged to play, even if they were, you know, more mature officers, to do something, a walk or to take some physical activity, and give them time off to do it. But it was also about then, if they were footballers or they were soccer players or volleyball players, to, in a community policing program, to go and work with the youths that were unemployed or the school kids, to build the confidence and trust. We brought in the Police Citizens Youth Club concept, which is an Australian idea. We introduced that, and it took off like wildfire. We ended up with this huge building that they were able to raise money for, and donors came in and funded this massive complex in one of the, what was one of the most crime-prone areas in Suva. And for a period of several months, there was not one crime apart from domestic violence. There was no robberies. The youths were all engaged in it. They were happy. They had a car wash set up. They got some brush cutters for them, you know, and they were doing gardening for the council. and getting paid, and some of the money was going to the PCYC. It was a real success story. It got a lot of international media attention. So these community policing projects are essential to engage with the community.
Were there also boards in which citizens sat with police?
Yeah, I can't take credit for that. That was in existence before I got there. They call them crime prevention committees. These are neighbourhood sort of based, they would assist the police and sometimes go on joint patrols with the police. They would raise funds so that the police could have torches and paint their police stations and things and buy them limited sort of modest equipment to help, you know, in the office. They were good.
There were dozens of those.
Yeah, look, what works in Fiji may not work anywhere else, because you have to take into account the cultural setting, the context in which you're operating. You know, what works, what won't work, you know. Fiji are very communal people. Family is very important. The sense of belonging is really, really critical to them. They love to put the uniform on because they belong to something. The tribal sort of context, you know what I mean? I'm not being derogatory. I think it's a very positive thing. I wish more countries had that. You know, if I could say it, I think the United States is a very individualistic society. So you'd have to take a different approach in a society like this. You know, that wouldn't work. A lot of the places we have peacekeeping missions have quite complex and different. Sudan and Darfur, you know, they're different to Fiji. So you've got to look at it and understand the culture, what are the things that turn them on and what are the things that turn them off, and focus on the things that work.
Were there any other ingredients of success there that you'd like to highlight for people working in other parts of the world?
Marrying in, I think the real trick is just building on what I said just then about taking in local culture. It's don't throw away the good things about a local police force just because they're different, just because they're something you've not seen before. Really, you need to go in with an open mind. Bring ideas in, sure, everyone expects that, and that's why you're paid to do your job, but be open as well. And remembering that there's always lots of ways to address a problem, and just because you're the commissioner doesn't mean that your idea is necessarily better than anyone else's. So explore all options, and in many cases you can do a hybrid solution, where you think, well, that's a good idea, but this is a good idea, so let's sort of meld them together and come up with something quite new and innovative for that local setting. So I think just keeping an open mind and being committed, 100% to it, and that will, the energy you have will infect others. Yeah?
Earlier in our conversation about your current role, you spoke about the variety of ways in which UN police are now involved in different parts of the world, and increasingly that is a rehabilitation reform role in many places. How did your experience in Fiji or your experience in Timor shape the way you are going at those issues within the UN now?
Oh, I just clarify that I've not actually worked in Timor.
In Timor, yes.
No. I've managed contingent Australian contingents through there, and I've just completed an expert review. I led an expert team in on police reform, but so really my time with Fiji and the AFP is where this reform experience has come. But in answer to your question about the Fiji part, it's been invaluable to understand, you know, what reform's all about. Because when I came, they were under-resourced, underpaid, demoralised, traumatised. They were traumatised over the coup. I had to get counsellors in and all sorts of things going on. It was not dysfunctional. It was functional, but not very. So I think that's the sort of general synopsis that could apply to a lot of the police forces in conflict, post-conflict environments in which we operate. So understanding, you know, how to help the broken biscuits in that thing and become whole biscuits again is pretty good experience. And you know, I'm happy to share that with others when I visit the various missions. Mm-hmm. But again, I stress, you know, I don't think that everything that we did in Fiji would apply everywhere. But there are some things, and there are some generic approaches which have widespread application and utility.
People who play equivalent roles in many parts of the world also face the challenge that you did in Fiji, that there are often political organizations in the wings, maybe security groups that aren't recognized as official security groups or military or other organizations that would like to take power.
Yeah.
You suggested that the police were able to hold this off for some time.
Oh, yeah.
What enabled the police services to do that? Was it a matter of simply policing arms shipments and other kinds of things more rigorously? What steps could a police force take in that kind of setting?
I think the overarching thing is the rule of law. That's our job, is to enforce the law. To all of these conflicts, there's a legal in the system. You know, these are not, you're not allowed to overthrow a government. There's very few countries that have laws that say it's okay to overthrow a government. You know, normally governments enact things to protect themselves. So you'll find something there, whether it's treason or treasonable offences or sedition or conspiracy or, you know, inchoate type of offences, or to conduct a major spoiling operation, whether it's a rebel group, militias, or whether it's a political group that are taking a militant role, they will have to do some overt acts which break the law somewhere along the line, whether it's amassing weapons, whether it's having meetings without a permit or anything really, getting finances and not declaring and abusing the finance system. There's always going to be something you'll find to hang your hook in, and that's what you need to do. You need to then investigate that, present the brief of evidence to the prosecuting authorities, and hopefully if they are independent and performing properly, they will agree that offences have been committed and arrest warrants can be issued. Now that has, I mean, sensitive, but you know, with President Bashir, I mean, there has been an impact from the ICC decision. I won't go into, obviously I'm constrained from talking too much about the politics of all of that, but you know, people listen. People, when there's an arrest warrant for you, whether it's for, you know, committing a crime locally or doing something more serious, human nature is you're going to sort of, it's going to have some impact on you. So it certainly did in Fiji, you know, the fact that we were, and I was saying, oh, I can arrest the commander, but I can't get near him and his senior team. So it did slow them down. It didn't force them to rethink strategy. It wasn't a clear run to do this. They had to be careful, and they had to continually look over their shoulder. Ultimately, it could have stopped it. If he had been arrested overseas, then the head of the snake would have been cut off, and the rest would have died. Confident of that, but. It wasn't to be. So I think if we get to that point in a, you know, if we have these major spoilers in a post-conflict setting or a pre-conflict setting, by enforcing the rule of law, you do create that opportunity to prevent it, but certainly the opportunity to make them think twice, to make them continually reassess and be nervous about it. This is not a straightforward, you know, run at the touchline.
I actually had a question just to pull it back a bit. I understand that when you were in Fiji, you were involved in pursuing and attempting to bring people to justice for events in Ulfuku of 2000. And I was wondering how that worked, because on the one hand, you're undertaking this major modernization and reform operation, and you also engage in this very sort of sensitive and, I imagine, difficult work of trying to address past crimes.
Yeah.
Would you mind talking a little bit about
that? Not at all. No.
About that?
No, we did. Look, you know, you've got to be able to walk and chew gum in this business. And so it was a matter of keeping a number of balls in the air. And I had a commissioner's task force set up that operated in a secure environment, and they were handpicked, good investigators, well led by a solid, strong Fijian assistant commissioner. They reported to me. We ended up charging the vice president, the speaker of the house, a number of cabinet ministers, a number of senior public servants, a number of police officers, and other members of the public. So, you know, we did it. We applied the law. People wanted to know what happened in 2000. I was under a lot of pressure from the opposition, who were the victims of it, plus the members of the public through the media, about what happened. They want to know what happened. So by pursuing again this, the justice approach to it, we were able to divulge through the courts and the media reporting of the trials and the so on, a lot of what actually happened. And that was part of the healing process for Fiji. You know, talked about reconciliation. The government wanted reconciliation. They wanted to leap to reconciliation. My view was, yes, we all want reconciliation, but you won't have reconciliation until you have understanding. From understanding, you then have acceptance. Acceptance, reconciliation. You can't just go from, we don't know what the hell happened, it was a terrible traumatic thing and I feel terribly traumatised, to, I'm just going to reconcile. There's a number of steps in the middle. So this was part of that, understanding, accepting, and then reconciling. That's how I saw it.
I had another very specific question. I believe it's called the Police Critical Task, Critical Response Unit, sorry.
Tactical, PT, Peace Tactical Response,
sorry,
PTR, yeah.
Sorry, yeah. I understand that when Bainimarama, thank you, took over, he tried to disarm or disband.
He did.
I was wondering the story behind that.
Yeah. Well, to be honest, I didn't think it was going to be as controversial as it turned out to be. This was a group of, they had what they called the police mobile unit. They were mainly about civil disorder. They'd roll them out if there was a demonstration. They did an okay job. Well, we were confronted by a range of things. They had no search and rescue capability. They had no water police, underwater search and rescue capability. They had no serious armed offender resolution capability. And we were getting hit by armed robberies. Some of them were with weapons. Some of them shots were fired. They shot up a bank in one town, and then they shot at police as they were fleeing, you know, just like a Hollywood movie. And our response was inadequate. So I recognised the need that they had to have the capability to do all of these things. Now, we were too small to have a SWAT team dedicated and a dive team and a water police and all this sort of stuff. So we thought, well, we'll have a tactical group that a lot of this will be multi-skilled, so they'll all be able to do civil disorder. Some of them will be able to do armed offender, those that were good, reliable officers who knew how to handle a weapon and could shoot straight, basics, and knew when to shoot, more importantly, and when not to, even more important. So we set that up. We had water police. We were able to get AusAid to buy us a big, beautiful police launch from New South Wales Police in Australia, ex-Olympics from 2000. And the dive team. So this was like a group of men, some women, not enough, but some women. They were physically fit and special trained, and there was a sense that I got that they were becoming elite. You know, they were designing their own uniform and badges and stuff. So what I would do is insist that they do school crossings in the morning to help school kids cross major roads, to go out and do community policing patrols with the general police around the stations to break down this elitist thing, because I told them, you remember the Fiji police, you happen to be in a specialist squad. that you first and foremost, like me, and I'd do it too, I mean, not the kids bit, but I'd go around it on patrol to show them if I can do it, you can do it. So I'd go on night shifts and do all sorts of stuff. So, you know, I'd lead by example, sort of example, I think. That we managed it that way, and they were given 20 Heckler & Koch submachine guns for the Armed Defender Resolution Group, just 20, and some Glock, we got 100 Glock pistols. Some of those went to Kosovo, where we had a contingent of police. 30 of them went to Kosovo, 70 stayed behind. So where there was an armed offender situation, we could respond with an armed response. Whether it was, you know, these Heckler & Koch are a tactical weapon used by SWAT teams, many SWAT teams around the world. They're short range, low velocity, a military weapon. You fire it, you know, your lethal shot can be a mile plus. These are not like that. These are for urban, close confine, short barrel, but they can do automatic fire, but they won't go a mile. You know, your killing range is a couple hundred metres, I think. So, you know, it's a police tactical weapon. Now, the military became really agitated about this because they see themselves, obviously, because they were going to do a coup, as being the sole armed instrument in Fiji. And no one else was to have arms, so they became totally out of proportion. We went and spoke to them, we briefed them on it, we invited them to come and have a look. They wouldn't come, but I briefed them on it, and they admitted they were paranoid about it. Told them, look, there's nothing to be paranoid about. This is a police function, and we're not going to get involved in your business, and, you know, you want to fight the enemy, whoever they happen to be, you know, you do that, but we'll deal with crime. But anyway, in the end, as you rightly point out, Daniel, when they took over, they went straight to the armory, took all the guns and disbanded the tactical response team. It's been reformed as the old mobile team, which is just about civil disorder and stuff. It's nowhere near the level that we were getting. We were getting overseas training. I sent guys overseas. We had instructors come to Fiji. Oh, they took over the close protection duties for the Prime Minister and other visiting heads of state. They did Princess Anne, a number of Prime Ministers, the President of China. Who visited Fiji, they were close protection for those, armed close protection. So they're a professional group. Yeah, for another 5 minutes. Yeah.
Those are sort of the key questions I had.
I don't know how comfortable you feel talking about this. We will edit our questions on this. But I wonder whether you would talk a little bit about the support role that the UN is playing in places like Haiti. These are particularly challenging roles, and I wonder if you could sort of outline the kinds of challenges that you face in those settings as opposed to the Darfur peacekeeping in context, as opposed to the reform and rehabilitation.
Yeah.
What you're providing.
Yeah, in a number of our missions we have a dual role, operation support and reform, or in the case of Timor and Kosovo, it's been interim law enforcement and reform. So these are quite different tasks. Now, when we get our UN police arriving, these are what I describe as the general off-the-shelf utility police officer that comes probably very good in his or her home environment, you know, experience of a minimum of 5 years. But that doesn't mean that they can pass that knowledge on and do reform and design a whole reform plan for a police force. This is complex specialist work, so I think the way we're recruiting our UNPOLs has to be revisited. I think we need to have professional posts in the field that are experts in this, rather than just relying on, you know, the bunches of UNPOLs coming in, and hopefully someone in that group has got some experience in this or has some ability in this area. Now, the operation support side we generally do well because, as I said, this is, you know, a lot of familiarity with that side of it, but the reform area is where we struggle. I visited Timor, as I said, looked at the police there. That was an area we struggled. I went to Haiti. The operation support work is good, but we're struggling in some areas on the reform because of that. We got this generic off-the-shelf police officers that turn up. So we need to be more specific in certain skill sets that we need in the missions. So So getting that mix right is going to be the challenge for us as we move more and more into this style of work.
This need not be part of the tape, but I'm very curious too. The term of your office is 2 years, but it seems scarcely enough time to come up to speed.
Yeah,
and
no,
then,
no, yeah.
And then do
it's been 10 months, it seems like 10 minutes. Well, it's 2 years, and then, you know, I think unless you threaten to kidnap the Secretary General, you actually get a third year. I'm not sure whether the Australian government would agree to that, or my Home Force would agree to that, or my wife would agree to that, but it's 2 years minimum, and often it's three. Neither of my two predecessors went for the third year, so I don't know, because there are a lot of demands on it, and I've got a career back home that I've got to sort of keep an eye on as well. But the maximum you can do as a seconded officer is 4 years. You can't go beyond that. That's the rules. And it's very rare that we offer 4 years.
Mm-hmm. But it places a great premium on the information system of the UN in
yeah.
order to minimize that
yeah.
time required. To
well, I'm fortunate that we have a deputy now, Anne-Marie Orla from Sweden. She's recently arrived and terrific, great lady, very experienced. But I think in time, consideration should be given to professionalising that post so that there's continuity in the deputy position. You can second police advisors through rotation or, you know, from time to time, but I think there needs to be a deputy should be a permanent position.
Thank you. I am mindful of your time because we're now a little bit over. It would be wonderful at some later date to be able to come back
Absolutely.
And speak further.
I'm delighted
this
to help.
Is a great beginning.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll be editing some of our rougher questions, and all the tape can be edited easily, so when you get the transcript, you say, yeah, I would really like to put this
Thanks, I'm sure it'll be fun.
You can do that. But thank you very, very much.
Pleasure.